On the Record on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Great minds think unalike. It all adds up to the new equation.
Now, a new book, The Colour of Ireland, compiled by Rob Cross, is likely to spark some considerable debate, just as last year's runaway success, Old Ireland in Colour. In fact, if you've been to a bookshop in the last 12 or 18 months in the time that they've been open, I'm sure you'll have seen that work by Sally Ann Buckley and John Breslin, Old Ireland in Colour. It has been selling like hot cakes. There's a sequel out now as well, and I'm sure that it's something you probably have seen, if indeed you're going into a bookshop to pick up a copy of Henrietta Street from Tenement to Suburbia, written by our illustrious contributor right now. If you're not familiar with the concept, the books take historic images in black and white and they reimagine them in colour. And to some, that has some entertainment value, to some others that it has educational value, but there are some who believe that in fact there are neither. Donald Fallon, who I mentioned there, the author of Henrietta Street from Tenement to Suburbia, he has taken the opposite view to Dermot Ferriter, but both of them have written introductions to The Colour of Ireland, which has been compiled by Rob Cross. And they're really articulating some of the debate that there is now, not just on social media, but in historical circles around this whole idea of taking old black and white footage and adding new colour to it to try and represent, reanimate, reillustrate. I don't even know what the right verb would be, but Donald is here now to talk more about it. Donald, great to see you as ever.
Gav, I have to say, I think writing books about housing and Dublin or biographies of Enda Kenny, we're in the wrong game, really, you know, because this is where the public interest
is. This is where they all are, yeah. The next time there's a downfall of a Taoiseach, I am just not writing a book about that. Before getting into photography, I suppose we should probably reflect on the role that visual images have played in how we view the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And even before photography, I mean, the key moments of Irish history in their own ways are all shaped by kind of visual references, visual material. Mm. And before photography itself, that was true. It's impossible to imagine our school textbooks on the famine without the illustrations of James Mahoney, which are just incredible. You know, they appeared in the Illustrated London News. They've become the kind of dominant visual representation of the famine, particularly that one of the starving mother with her two children by her side. So, you know, visual references go back before photography. But, you know, the suffering of Ireland during that period would, you know, perhaps have brought home to the world in a much realer way how bad things were here had photography been on the island. Now, surprisingly, listeners might be surprised to hear this, by the time of the famine, photography was already a thing. You know, the early pioneers of photography were achieving success elsewhere, but it hadn't really entered popular usage or mainstream culture. So then by the time of kind of later humanitarian disasters, you know, the concentration camps and the Boer War in South Africa, for example, it's actually images themselves, you know, by the late 19th century, it's photographs that are moving people. So you know, the pen of Mahoney, which was useful during the famine, is replaced by actual, you know, photographic images of starving children. Mm. But many people in the Ireland of the 1840s would have probably wished, you know, that such images could have brought the reality of what was happening here to a global audience. So visual images have existed long before photography.
Yeah, and there might not have been very many photographical representations of life in the famine, but it's also quite possible that there might not be another island of its size, you know, pro rata, per square mile, that's been as photographed as widely as Ireland, or that's produced as many photographers as this country.
So Rob Cross and John Breslin before him, they've just got an incredible diversity of things that they can work with. And for such a small island, and this is a very small island by landmass and by population, we've been blessed, I think, by not alone producing such a fine body of photographers, but by, for whatever reason, attracting the photographers of the world here, you know, in search of kind of Irish authenticity. So most of the great photographers of the 20th century at least passed through Ireland. Lee Miller, a female photographer, despite a name that would suggest otherwise, fashion photographer turned war correspondent, took amazing pictures of World War II, then arrives in Dublin and snaps Dublin 1946 for Vogue magazine, of all things.
So she went back to being a fashion photographer.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And the Palace Bar of all fashionable abodes. So, you know, between native and kind of visiting talent, I think no city and definitely no country has been as well captured by the lens of photographers. But I think what is remarkable about the great photographers of 20th century Ireland is how many of them shot in black and white, even long after that was the only option. So, you know, so some living photographers come to mind. John Minahan, who took those amazing pictures of Samuel Beckett in Paris and London. Can you imagine those pictures of Beckett in full colour? I can't, actually. I think iconic Beckett images are so iconic because they're black and white. In sport, I think of Ray McManus from Sports File. Brilliant shots of a packed Dailyman Park, the game we talked about before.
I'd never taken that in because I think I might have tweeted that at the time, the photograph of people even packed up on top of the stands at Dailymount Park for that last game between Ireland and Italy, the game which basically heralded the movement of football from Dailymount to Lansdowne Road. Hadn't ever crossed my mind, of course, that was a time when colour photography was much more accessible. But again, still, the photographs were taken by Ray with all those people crammed on the stands in black and white.
And so many of Ray's kind of iconic crowd shots from Ireland games and other games are in black and white, you know, at a time when they didn't have to be. Eleanor Wiltshire, amazing collection of photographs, modern Irish history, especially the 1960s in the National Library. And again, they're all in black and white. So we have to ask, you know, and we could go on, Tony O'Shea, we could go on. Why did these photographers choose to shoot in an old format, some people might say, when the option of using colour was there?
Is there an argument maybe, and this is just a stab of the dark, was there a belief that colour might be a bit of a fad? That black and white was really where the staying power was going to be?
And where the art was, if you know what I mean. And Henri Cartier-Bresson, the French photographer, a master of the modern art of photography, he said that colour negates all of photography's three-dimensional values. So I think that sounds a little bit like Charlie Chaplin. You know, when Charlie Chaplin is deploring the arrival of the talkies, this is a fad, it will pass, and we'll be back to the great art form of silent cinema. But it's worth saying a lot of fine photographers would, in time, move between both worlds, between colour and black and white, as they felt the occasion demanded it.
Yeah, I suppose it's a little bit like people saying that e-books were going to be, you know, the new thing, or are they just going to be a fad, and are people still going to want the slightly inefficient but pleasurable experience of holding the final product in their hands? There, I suppose it is worth reflecting, though, when you're talking about whether people were still shooting in black and white when colour was available, that there wasn't anything new about colour, that the earliest colour photographs of this island are more than a century old.
That blows my mind. Actually, colour photography has been around surprisingly long. Two French photographers come to Ireland in 1913, and they're believed to have taken the first colour photos of Irish life. And there's a documentary in this for someone willing to make it, because they're part of this incredibly wide-ranging and ambitious project called the Archives of the Planet. And that's if you're applying for funding and the thing is called the Archives of the Planet, you've got odds.
You're going to need a few grants for that one, though. Yeah, there's a lot to get through.
The aim was to capture human society as it was, and the great belief that was common actually throughout the world in the early 20th century that, you know, the old great civilizations were passing away. So it was really romantic in scope. They went from Connemara to the Boyne Valley, and you actually have no sense when you look at these 1913 color photos. So this was the same year that an industrial dispute was ripping the capital apart. This is the year of the lockout, to put it in context. But we see really vivid colour. There's the red in a traditional Galway cape worn by one female subject that just pops out of the shot. Yeah. And this thing, the Archives of the Planet, 22 years it went on. They took 72,000 colour images in more than 50 countries. And eventually the Wall Street crash put an end to its resources and to its ambition. Wait. So this is not new. You know, the colour photography was something that was in existence more than a century ago.
Yeah, you're right. I'm really taken by that idea that there's an archive somewhere, the archive of the archives of the planet. It's sitting there somewhere, and that there's 72,000 colour images from like the early part of the 20th century that are all sitting there just waiting to be unleashed on the world. It's the sort of thing that I'd imagine they'll get Peter Jackson to do next, now that he's done World War One and he's done the Beatles, now that he'll have something else to occupy his time. To get to the debate about all of this, to some people, there is a real like moral debate, because there's some people who would say that it makes the things that are being depicted more approachable or more realistic, more tangible to a modern audience. And then there are others who say that trying to add colour to a black and white picture somehow lessens the originals.
Yeah, look, if an image is taken in black and white, is it actually morally right to reimagine or adjust it? And in his introduction to the book, myself and Dermot Ferter were kind of both invited to reflect on this. And that's kind of scary, actually, because Ferter was my supervisor in college, so we've gone full circle.
Does he still get to mark your homework now? He gets to like, hand you back a copy of the book with red pen written all over it.
Look, Ferter's done more than anyone to popularise history, modern history in this country, and he makes a really compelling argument against the practice of doing this. He says that, you know, it is true that the originals remain to be viewed, but the increasing momentum behind colourisation and the unending quest to improve on things or make them easier for us to relate to also holds out the danger of the originals becoming marginalised.
Okay. So he's on the sceptical side about this recolourisation, and you take the opposite view.
Yeah, I struck a kind of more positive note, you know, but I think that there needs to be health warnings on these things. And, you know, the debate, I think, about colourising images, a lot of it's been going on for decades, but it strikes me that the more recent controversies are actually more about presentation. It's not about the actual act of colorizing these images, it's about how you present them, and it's really entangled in kind of social media, as everything
okay,
is.
Okay, well, I suppose
nowadays.
On that note, then, because there is a famous Twitter page which has, on more than one occasion, it's been criticized for presenting color photographs as if they were the original, and they don't actually mention that they've actually been transformed.
History in pics, at History in pics, more Twitter followers than the two of us combined. 3.4 million at the time I sat down to think about all of this a few weeks ago. 3.7 million now. 3.7 million people. It's extraordinary. Wow. Followed his Twitter page. It's enormous. And it posts historical images. But the problem with History in pics is they do it without pretty much any context whatsoever. It's just a picture.
Oh, right, okay.
So they put up this great image of Golden Gate Bridge. It pops from your screen in vivid colour. The cars all look fantastic. And the caption was, Golden Gate Bridge, 1940. No mention that it had been colourised. And it could kind of easily be presumed that that was an unadjusted primary source.
Yeah.
Millions of people look at that. It's shared by thousands of people. And you have to ask, there is a good question. You know, could an image like that surpass its original in search engines? Does that become the authentic and the more familiar image? When there's guesswork at play, really, in terms of like the colour of cars and other things?
Well, that was it. That I was going to say that. I imagine the guesswork, even if it is, you know, there's good estimates and there's a lot of sophisticated analysis going into the colour tones, that it is only ever going to be a guess at the exact colour or the exact tint that was going to be portrayed in the original. I suppose the happy compromise might be that if you are going to have a colourised version, that you do make sure that the original doesn't lose its promise.
Yes, absolutely. I think when you present them beside their original black and white images, and it's made clear that we're looking at a colourised reimagining of the past, I think a lot of these concerns kind of around confusion, they fade away. And the images, the colourised images, kind of move to the realm of entertainment, and there's nothing really wrong with that, you know. Mm. And it's interesting to me that, you know, John Breslin and Rob Cross, they're both Twitter success stories, in
yes,
a sense,
yeah,
because
yeah.
these images, you know, they spark discussion and reflection on social media. I think that's the reason these books exist. And Rob's hashtag is great, The Colour of Ireland. And really what you're looking at is not just the images, but the memories, the discussion, that flow therefrom.
What I do like about Rob's book is that it also makes a point of trying to include pictures from every county. So it's The Colour of Ireland county by county, so that if you're from some of the more forgotten parts of the country, at least there is some depiction of what life was like in times past. I suppose ultimately there's a reminder in all of this, and it's a very 21st century problem, that people do need to approach all images, not just the old black and white ones, with a certain degree of skepticism.
Yeah, fake news, you know, that term that made its impact on our world in recent times. It isn't just colourised photos that, you know, can be playful with the truth. There's a great little yarn about a black and white series of images that appeared in the British press during the War of Independence. The Battle of Tralee on the front of the Illustrated London News, a victory over the IRA, captured and dead rebels all over the place. And it's been discovered in recent times that actually those pictures were taken at Killiney in Dublin. No such battle happened.
Maybe it was a typo. Maybe they thought it was Killarney, not Killiney.
The photographer was kind of doing his bit, you know, as it was for the British war effort. And when morale was very, very low in Britain towards the war in Ireland, this was a sign of
some success in some battle somewhere.
Fake news. So, you know, whenever we pick up a camera, we do have the power to distort as well. And that's before, you know, adding any colour to the equation. But I think this project, Colour of Ireland, I think it's been an overwhelmingly good thing. Any engagement with the historic past and popular culture is a good thing. As I said, we owe a lot to Ferriter on that. Mm. And like, history is in our lives in Ireland in a very real way. You know, the Sunday morning radio slots, the printed press always dig into the archives. And if these projects kind of inspire people to go back and look at the originals, then I think their job has been pretty successful.
I suppose there's a bit of a danger that if you start putting too much credence into approximations or reproductions of what were the original, that then this might sound like it's a little bit over the top, and tell me if it is, that it doesn't seem like that much of a leap before you start doing deep fakes of historical addresses, so that somebody gets a really good picture of Abraham Lincoln and someone who gets a really good voice actor, and they manage to approximate what it was like delivering the Gettysburg Address. And it could be very faithful, and it's not intended to mislead anyone, but then that becomes portrayed or perceived as an actual copy of him giving the address, and no one ever knows.
We're all going to be able to go and see Tupac soon, you know, like they're able to bring people back from the dead in some ways. I find the animation of historic images very, very unusual.
Yeah.
Very weird on one level. But I think, what Rob and John and others do is something else entirely.
No reanimation involved in Henrietta Street from Tenement to Suburbia, which is available in all good bookshops, alongside The Colour of Ireland and Old Ireland in Colour, which is now available in a second edition as well, because it's been selling like such hot cakes. Donald Fallon is the author of Henrietta Street from Tenement to Suburbia, and he's also the presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast on Dublin history, which you'll find anywhere you get your audio online.